Today we continue in Judges. We're getting close to the end. We finished off Samson last week. And now we're up to a portion of the Judges that doesn't introduce any further judges to the nation for the rest of the book. And it tells us of a nation that had no real direction or no desire to follow God as they had been instructed to. The main idea of chapters 17 and 18, and then we get to 19, 20, and 21, which is similar, is about a people who had the right words but insisted that it was okay with God if they worshiped God on their own terms, not His. This cause became the catalyst that set in motion an array of devastating effects. And these events were not simply the result of chance, but of choices. That's a quote from Gary Phillips. There is some discussion among scholars about the timing of the events starting in Judges 17 and all the way through 21. G. Campbell Morgan held that the events in these chapters took place shortly after the death of Joshua. I don't agree with that. It makes sense that they follow chronologically in the book in that they show a further following away of the nation after Samson. And if you go back to right after the death of Joshua, the nation were serving and worshiping the Lord with much more devotion than they were at the end of the book of Judges in the later years. In fact, the first part of the book of Judges said that, you know, for the first generation after Joshua, they kept following the Lord, and then it just kept getting worse and worse. And we see worsening conditions, at least with regard to their spiritual life and following the Lord. And we'll see this starting in verse 1 of chapter 17, where we are introduced to a name by the name of Micah. Like we said just a minute ago, this is not the Micah who wrote the book. It says, "Now there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. He said to his mother, 'The 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about what you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. I took it.' And his mother said, 'Blessed be my son by the Lord.' He then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, and his mother said, 'I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord, for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now therefore I will return them to you.' So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah." Now, you probably haven't run across this passage in your casual reading of the Bible, you know, unless you're reading through it. This, I doubt very much if you've ever heard a message given on this. Tom, when you were a pastor, did you ever give a sermon on Judges 17?
I never preached through Judges.
Oh, okay.
I've read it.
But chapter 17 begins with this certain vagueness. We are introduced to a man from Ephraim named Micah. And Micah means, "Who is like the Lord?" Then we are told that he stole 1,100 pieces of silver from his mother. Now, we'll find out that Micah was an adult. It wasn't like he had a 15-year-old kid at this time. Right? You also may remember that this is the same amount that the Philistines paid Delilah to find out the source of Samson's strength. 163 pounds, if I remember right, of silver. And then in verse 2, for whatever reason, Micah went to his mother and admitted to taking the silver, and he returned it to her. Now, this change of heart may have been related to him hearing his mother utter a curse, because it says here, which were taken in verse 2, which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing. I have read that in ancient Near East cultures, curses carried an influence. And from the text, Micah returned the silver, which was, again, 1,100 pieces, a lot of silver, only after hearing this curse, which the mother put on the thief. So here the curse of the mother happens, or it seems to have had quite an impact on getting Micah to admit to the theft and return the stolen silver. How long it was stolen, we don't know, but he stole it. And Micah, like I said, he was an adult stealing from his mother, which would have been an elderly woman by this time. But what'd the mother do? Micah returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, who then uttered the words of consecration over the fortune to the Lord for my son to make an idol. Okay? So Micah was to blend the worship of the one true God with the superstitious worship of the Canaanites. Using the ephod and teraphim together, teraphim were small household items, and this dedication of one's wealth to the covenant Lord in order to make an idol was totally incongruous with what they had been taught. One person said it was a bizarre contradiction in terms. Make an idol to the Lord. So the mother was dedicating silver to the Lord, she said anyway, to Yahweh. And you also might have noticed that she said when she got the money back, I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord. But in reality, she spent 200 of the 1,100 shekels and kept 900. Apparently keeping the 900. We don't know what happened to the other 900. But she didn't wholly give it. She gave 200 of it. Now, the act of making a graven image was totally inappropriate and a sin before God. But it did not appear to raise any concerns with regard to breaking God's law and creating false worship. Now, in this section, we see several of God's commandments broken. You might have thought, well, first of all, stealing. He stole. Second of all, he stole from who? His mother. Now, I think there's a verse in the Ten Commandments that says, honor your father and mother. I don't think you honor them by stealing all their stuff. Making a graven image. Now, they were making a graven image, theoretically, of the Lord, or to the Lord. But then we also see that they had all these teraphim, small household items, so they were serving other gods. So just real quickly, there's four of them right there that were just blown out of the water as far as the Ten Commandments go. And as we look around the landscape of churches today who call themselves Christian, I got thinking about this. We can't help but see that much of the so-called worship today is false worship. Because that's what they were thinking they were doing. I'm worshiping God. I made this image. I'm going to worship and give it to the Lord. But what we see is people worshiping a false god today under the guise of Christianity. Sadly, too many prefer to worship the god of their own making and worship that god in the way they prefer to do so. I have seen many examples from all over, various churches and various denominations, I decided not to show any examples. We could bring up YouTubes. But I think we'd have to have barf bags for most of you to watch this stuff. Because it's horrid stuff. And it's going on today in church after church and denomination after denomination. People are worshiping the God the way they want to worship God, and it's the God of their own making. And they totally ignore what's said in Scripture. And you see it all the time. In mega churches and in micro mini churches. Churches that used to be big, but now we're small. They're just, it's everywhere.
And then they take it into businesses and all education.
Well, they take it everywhere.
Yeah.
Now we have verse 5. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household items and consecrated one of his sons that he might become a priest. Well, we see more problems here. Micah's sin against the Lord continues. Here he makes an ephod and household idols. Literally, it says teraphim, which were gods that were worshipped to get prosperity and guidance. And what do we have today? We have so-called Christian churches that want to give prosperity and guidance. From gotquestions.org, again, Bruce's favorite site.
Not sponsored.
What's that?
Not sponsored.
Not sponsored. No, I don't get any money from them. It said, Micah made an ephod and a teraphim, or an idol, for his sanctuary. The most natural inference from all these passages is that the ephod here signifies an image that was set up in the sanctuary, especially since the word is cited with teraphim, which undoubtedly refers to graven images. The conclusion is that ephod in these cases refers to a portable idol. Some scholars have suggested that the connection between the idol and the garment is that the idol was originally clothed in a linen garment, and the term ephod gradually came to describe the idol as a whole. So it probably wasn't an ephod like a priest, you know, wear that breastplate, a little bit different. Terry Brensinger wrote this. He says, with his entire collection of religious objects now intact, Micah finally positions them with his personal shrine. Micah, in other words, owns and operates his own sanctuary, a sanctuary that perhaps attracts a following from among the neighbors. Importantly, however, such a sanctuary has no clear claim to legitimacy. Nothing, for example, associates it in any way with genuine Israelite worship and tradition. He is doing his own thing. And, you know, and then he wants to set up his son that he might become a priest. Well, who were supposed to be priests? Levites. Okay, was he a Levite? No. He's doing his own thing his own way.
Bruce,
yes?
My version says that he might become his priest, like he had his own personal.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, it's his own personal priest. He's got his own idols, he's got his own little sanctuary, he's got everything else, now he has his own little priest, and boy, we're just set up.
Yeah.
And then in verse 6, very telling verse. And in those days there is no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And we're seeing that with Micah right here.
Now, Bruce, when it says that, does that imply that this was written during the period of the kings?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, and we'll see that later on, that it was written later. Yeah, come back to that. So written later when there was kings and a little history looking back on it. Now, we see this mentioned multiple times in the book of Judges, both that there was no king in Israel, and both that every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now, it was not because there was no king in Israel that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. They did what was right in their own eyes because they had little to no regard for the law that God had given to them. In what we just read, the idol the woman made, or that he had made, was not an idol of Baal. It was not an idol of Dagon or any of the false gods of the area. It was an idol of the Lord. That's horrible. That's actually worse in a sense. One commentator wrote this. He said, they were sincere in their worship, but they were absolutely wrong. Self-deceived, self-deluded, and under the wrath of God. And I got thinking about that. God does not and never will honor sincere worship if it's not correct worship. He offers correct worship. There are billions, and I use the word be on purpose, of people in the world that are sincere in their worship. Take a look at the cults. Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, they're sincere. Absolutely sincere. But they're sincerely wrong. How about the Muslims who flew the planes into the World Trade Center? Were they sincere? Oh, you bet. But God does not honor sincere unbelief. Sadly, and this is extremely sadly in my mind, many in the evangelical community incorrectly reason is sincerity is what counts. There are quotes from people like Joel Osteen that promote this heresy. Even Billy Graham, on May 31st, 1997, said this when asked by Robert Shuler. This is the conversation. Shuler said this, tell me, what do you think is the future of Christianity? Graham responded, well, Christianity and being a true believer, you know, I think there's the body of Christ. This comes from all the Christian groups around the world, outside the Christian groups. I think everybody that loves Christ or knows Christ, whether they're conscious of it or not, they're members of the body of Christ. He goes on, I think James answered that, the Apostle James in the first council in Jerusalem, when he said that God's purpose for this age is to call out a people for his name, and that's what God is doing today. He's calling people out of the world for his name. And whether they come from the Muslim world, or the Buddhist world, or the Christian world, or the non-believing world, they are members of the body of Christ because they've been called by God. They may not even know the name of Jesus, but they know in their hearts that they need something that they don't have, and they turn to the only light they have, and I think they are saved and they are going to be with us in heaven. Shuler responded, what? I said that with the wrong emphasis. What? What I hear you saying, that it's possible for Jesus to come into human hearts and soul and life, even if they've been born in darkness and have never been had exposure to the Bible. Is that a correct interpretation of what you are saying? Graham said, yes, it is, because I believe that. Hold up. Okay, going on. He said, I've met people in various parts of the world in tribal situations that they have never seen a Bible or heard about a Bible and never heard of Jesus, but they've believed in their hearts that there was a God, and they've tried to live a life that was quite apart from the surrounding community in which they live. Then Shuler replied, he said he trips over his tongue for his moment, his face beaming, and then he said, I'm so thrilled to hear you say this. There's a wideness in God's mercy. And Graham said, there is. There definitely is. That's horrible stuff.
That is.
It's kind of weird because you're listening to what he's saying, and it's like half of it is yes, okay, all right, and then he drops the ball. And he says something else, and you're like, okay, yeah, I agree with that. And then the last part of the sentence, it doesn't make any sense. Like, what he said is basically that there are people that God is calling out of the Muslim world and the Buddhist world. And yeah, that's true. And then he says,
but they're not becoming Christians.
They're not becoming Christians.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
they're
man.
Not connected.
Because I hear a lot of times they say, like, deception isn't deception unless it's like kind of murky waters, like a lawyer would say.
Great point.
Yeah. And then when you said his grace is wide, and that's in direct contradiction of strive to enter through the narrow gate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So.
No, great point. Great point. But that's the actual conversation. Okay? Yes. It was in 1997 when he said this.
Really? So
it was in May 31st, 1997, I believe. I wrote it down somewhere.
I mean, Jesus said to the woman at the well that God's worshipers must worship him in spirit and in truth.
And in truth, yeah. There's
so you can be sincere in your spirit, but if you're not, it's not true worship, it's not legitimate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're not the only ones that believe this. You know, Joel Osteen said the same thing.
And it gives false assurance.
Absolutely, it gives false assurance.
People hear back, oh, Billy Graham said that.
Yeah.
Now, was he goofy by then? Well, obviously he was goofy. No, did he always believe this? You can go back and find that there's always some seeds of this way back. But it wasn't as transparent then.
In the bulletin this morning, there's an elder's recommendation, which I would encourage everybody to read. But Jim starts out, and you probably know this very well, that Charles Spurgeon famously said, discernment is not knowing the difference between right and wrong. It is knowing the difference between right and almost right.
Right.
And that's what... Mm-hmm.
And the guy that pulled that quote for that thing was Dirk. He pulled that quote up. But... because I know he wrote the initial draft of it before we got, you know, they all get edited. But yeah, discernment is knowing the difference between truth and right and almost right. But what we see here is this departure from following God's commands. And the next thing we see Micah doing in departure from God's commands is in verse 7 to 13. In verse 5, we saw that he consecrated one of his sons that I might become his priest. But beginning in verse 7, hey, I got something better than that. Verse 7. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he was staying there. Then the man departed from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. Now, the first thing you notice that there's this man who's a Levite, which means he's from the tribe of Levi. So he was from the priestly tribe, and he was also from the family of Judah. So how could he be a member of both tribes, right? In Judges 18:30, we are told that this man, we'll find out his name is Jonathan, was a descendant of Moses, which Moses was of the tribe of Levi. So this shows that Jonathan was a Levite, but he was probably living within the tribe of Judah. Now, if we go back to Joshua 21, the Levite tribe had been assigned 48 cities to dwell in around the country. And Bethlehem, where this Jonathan was from, was not one of those cities. So he was really not supposed to be there, but nonetheless, that's where he was from. And he departed there, and he was trying to find a place to live when he met Micah. Going on in verse 9. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah. and I am going to stay wherever I may find a place. In other words, I am homeless. I got to find a spot. Micah then said to him, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance. So the Levite went in. The Levite agreed to live with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will prosper me. And I think this is just a very telling and sad, sad statement that Micah makes. Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing that I have a Levite as a priest. Boy, I got it all. I got the idol. I got the, the other idols, the teraphim. Now I got my own Levite. My mother is happy with me that I gave back the 1,100 pieces of silver that I stole. I'm on top of the world. So Micah thought that having Jonathan as his Levite priest was going to be much more beneficial than having his son as a priest. His son just kind of exits the picture. But when you're disobeying God's commands, it doesn't really matter if your priest was a Levite or not. You're a Levite, so you can be a priest. Well, so many things were wrong that this is not going to be successful, even though Micah said, I know that the Lord will prosper me. How do you know that? Because of all the commands you've disobeyed? He was sincere, but he was all goofed up. Now, of course, the Levite, Jonathan, was participating in the false worship that Micah had set up. But apparently he didn't have any issues with that. He now had a home, he had a salary, he had a place to live, got garments. He was in clover. Micah's very last statement here, now I know the Lord will prosper me, is very telling. If you go to 1 Samuel 16:7, we read that the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature. This was when he was selecting a king, right? Because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. As man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Micah was all about the outward appearance, and he thought that that would work and prosper him. Micah, like many today, looked at God as some type of cosmic genie, as someone to use to get what he wanted. Now I know the Lord will prosper me as I'm doing this also. I can get. I watched a YouTube this week of, I don't know how old it was, not that old, but it's one of these crazy idiot prosperity gospel guys, and told the story of, I got a gift from a guy, and it was a very, very, very lucrative gift worth in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. But this guy, and he told his name, he wanted a healing, and so he gave me this gift. Okay, are we back to buying indulgences now?
Simon the Sorcerer.
Yeah, very much like that. And this just came out. He gave him a Bentley, by the way, with a $175,000 add-on to it. Yes?
It's kind of the philosophy of the works religion.
Oh, very much.
We have a checklist. As long as we check everything off, we're going to be okay.
Yeah, it's definitely a philosophy of works.
And the focus is so checking the list.
Uh-huh. Yep. Good point.
By the way, Bruce, that guy died.
That guy died?
That he gave the Bentley to
him. Well,
the guy who received the Bentley?
No, so he gave him the Bentley so he get a healing, and he didn't get a healing.
He got a healing.
He got the car back.
Did he have to give the car back? That's a good question. Okay, going on.
The condition of the contract.
Yeah, right.
Chapter 18. So all that stuff was packaged in chapter 17. Now we go to chapter 18. What happened next? The first two verses. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Well, we just read that, so just saying it again. And in those days, the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in. For until then, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. So the people of Dan sent 5 able men from the whole of number of their tribe, from Zorah and from Eshtaol, to spy out the land and explore it. And they said to them, "Go and explore the land." And they came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, who lodged there. The first thing I thought about when reading the first few verses of chapter 18, it says, wait a minute. Time out. Wasn't the tribe of Dan allotted land by Joshua when he did it to each of his tribes? And if we go to Joshua 19, verse 40 to 46, we see that they did receive an allocation of land. Within those verses, we read, "And the territory of its inheritance included Zorah and Eshtaol," and it goes with a whole bunch of other cities. And verse 47, "When the territory of the people of Dan was lost to them, the people of Dan went up and fought against Leshem. After capturing it and striking it with the sword, they took possession of it and settled in it, calling Leshem Dan after the name of Dan, their ancestor." And that land was just west of Ephraim. So if you just went to Ephraim, which is a little bit north of the Dead Sea, and you go west toward the Mediterranean Sea, that's where you'd find it. I tried to print out a map, and it printed off very poorly, so I didn't put it in your notes because I couldn't get it to look very good. Bressinger wrote on this, he says, "According to Joshua 19, 40 to 46, the Danites originally received the area situated just west of Benjamin. Due to extreme pressure from both the Amorites and the Philistines," and we see that in other parts of Judges, "however, they never secured their position there. Now, finding themselves in an ever-narrowing corner, the Danites ultimately acknowledge defeat and seek refuge elsewhere. The reason they didn't have possession of the land that Joshua allotted to them is because they had disobeyed God when he told the nation to possess the land and to drive out the Canaanites. So instead of following God's direction, they sought an easier path, a path of less resistance, and that is go find a land that's suitable. Notice they sent out spies into the land to see if it was something they wanted. We're going to find the best. We're going to find a good spot. They sent spies into the land of their fellow countrymen." Okay? These were Israelites going after Israelites. Verse 3. "When they were in the house, or by the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite." Now that's interesting all in itself. But they recognized, and these were just 5 guys, they recognized. Isn't it interesting how voices sound familiar? It really is. You might not have been around somebody for 15 years, and they'll call you and you'll recognize their voice.
Do you think that they personally recognized him or that he had an accent?
Maybe both. You know, the accent might have put him onto it. "But then they turned aside and said to him," this is very interesting, "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What is your business here?" And he said to him, this is how Micah dealt with me. He has hired me, and I have become his priest. And they said to him, inquire of God, please, that we may know whether the journey on which we are setting out will succeed. In other words, you're a priest? Hey, tell us, are we going to be successful here? And the priest said to them, go in peace. The journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord. In other words, yeah, go for it. God's with you. When the five spies came to Micah's house, they recognized Jonathan's voice and they learned how he came to be there. And apparently without even seeking counsel, God told him to proceed. Now, the answer that he gave to the Danites is very typical of answer of false prophets that gave both in the Bible and still goes on today. A biblical example is found in Jeremiah 28 when Hananiah falsely prophesied what they wanted to hear, and that was not the truth. The result is that God took Hananiah's life in that same year in the seventh month, and we find that in Jeremiah 28:17. But boy, there are numerous parallels to today's so-called prophets. They are busy telling people what they want to hear. For example, I'm going to give you a couple examples, and I'm just going to give you the titles of the prophecies that these modern-day prophets give. These people claim to have heard directly from the Lord, and there are paragraphs written behind each one of these prophecies, and these are real. I just took these off the internet yesterday on this site that has hundreds of these a year, maybe thousands of these a year, all from different people. A guy named Nate Johnson, he prophesied this. The next 6 months will be a Red Sea moment. Then you can hear all about that. I don't know what in the world he's talking about. Bonnie Jones, yeah, there's female prophets and male prophets and maybe even some that are non-binary, I don't know. Quote, the breaker box is turning on again. Exclamation point. Get ready for light and power. Kim Potter, the hosts of heaven are working for you right now.
Do any of these predict the election?
Yeah, right. Some of them did 4 years ago. Chuck Pierce, who's a pretty well-known guy, and he is bad news. 21 days to restore joy and produce strength. Andrew Toe, you have crossed now into a new season. No, you have crossed into a now season. Anyway, it's going to tell you that all this stuff's going to happen to you now. And Sylvia Noosh, pioneers, you have entered the new frontier. And you could go on and on and on, and they're everywhere. That's enough. Give you any more, you might get sick. You wouldn't be able to digest your lunch. But these people, if you read them all, they're telling people what they want to hear. They have no more heard from the Lord than I am an NBA basketball all-star. But very similar to what we have in Judges 18. Now, like those who believe in the false prophets of today, because these people, there's tons of views, and oh boy, I'm going to take it, I'm going to claim it, and all that stuff, the Danites wanted to hear what Jonathan told them. And so they were more than happy to proceed. So we go to verse 7. The five men departed and came to Laish, and saw the people who were there, how they lived in security, after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing. That is in the earth and possessing wealth. And they were far from the Sidonians that had no dealings with anyone. And when they came to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtaol, their brothers said to them, what do you report? And they said, arise, let us go up against them, for we have seen the land. and behold, it is very good, and you will do nothing. So do not be slow to go and enter and possess the land. As soon as you go, you will come to an unsuspecting people. The land is spacious, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is in the earth. So Laish was about 25 miles from the Sea of Galilee. And as we read, those who lived there were doing well. They were not at odds with any other group. They were living peacefully. Boy, let's go retire there. What a great place, right? And it says they were living peacefully like the Sidonians. Now, Sidon was a city on the Mediterranean Sea and was well known for trade, not for war. So they compared the two. We are also told that it was fairly isolated, which would mean that they had few allies because they didn't need them, they thought, making a takeover easy. So the spies wanted to go quickly and take the land which was not allocated to them. And they even tried to tell everyone that God was on their side. God's telling us to go and take this land. You also notice in verse 10, it says, as soon as you go, it says, the land is spacious, for God has given it into your hands. You notice it doesn't say the Lord. It's using a different word for God. It's using the word Elohim there, not the word Yahweh. Elohim is the mighty one, not the I am or the self-existent one. So they're already, you know. It wasn't Elohim. Yahweh who told them that. Verse 11. So 600 men of the tribe of Dan, armed with weapons of war, set out from Zorah and Eshtaol, and they went up and encamped in Kiriath Jearim in Judah. On this account, that place is called Mahanadan to this day, and behold, it is west of Kiriath Jearim. And they passed there from the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. They wasted no time getting ready. It holds 600 people. That tells you that Laish wasn't that big, fully armed and ready. And they, by the way, they came by Micah's house. Then the five men who had gone out to scout, verse 14, then the five men who had gone to scout the country of Laish said to their brothers, do you know that in these houses there's an ephod, household gods, a carved image, and a metal image? Because they saw those while they were there. Now therefore consider what you will do. And they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite at the home of Micah and asked him about his welfare. Now the 600 men of the Danites, armed with their weapons of war, stood by the entrance of the gate. So they were showing their strength. And the five men who had gone to scout out the land went and entered and took the carved image and the ephod and the household gods and the metal image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. So Jonathan wasn't going to stop them. He wasn't going to try. He saw them doing everything they were doing. And when these went into Micah's house and took the carved image and the ephod and the household goods and the metal image, the priest said to them, what are you doing? And they said, keep quiet. Put your hand to your mouth and come with us and be a father and a priest. For it is better for you to be a priest to the house of one man or the priest to a tribe and a clan of Israel. Now we see Jonathan's real motivation here. What? And the priest's heart was glad. And he took the ephod and the household goods and the carved image and went along with the people. So he, sure, I'll join you. From this narrative, it's clear that he had no allegiance to Micah. Now, you may think that he felt compelled to go with the Danites because he feared for his safety. But verse 20 puts that to bed. It says his heart was glad. I got a better deal. So he did. We also see that the Danites also had no problem stealing items from Micah. They obviously had more strength than Micah, so they took what they wanted. Again, we see no compulsion to follow the commands given by the Lord. Remember what Judges 17:6 said. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And that's what we're seeing. One example of how it played out. So we go on to verse 21. So they turned and departed, putting the little ones and the livestock and the goods in front of them. And when they had gone a distance from the home of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house were called out, and they overtook the people of Dan. And they shouted to the people of Dan, who turned around and said to Micah, "What's the matter with you that you come with such a company?" And he said, "You take my gods that I made and the priest and go away, and what have I left? How then you ask me, what's the matter with you?" And the people of Dan said, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry fellows fall upon on you, and you lose your life with the lives of your household." Then the people of Dan went their way, and Micah saw they were too strong for him. He turned and went back to his home. Yep, they were right. They did kill him. Took all his stuff. So when they were confronted with their thievery, all they did was threaten death. "We're stronger than you. I have the power. You don't. I'm going to go. I'm going to take it." And Micah understood that, so he just went back home. So much for Micah's idol that's going to help him and protect him. It didn't. Right? And it's not going to help the Danites either. Then we go on. But the people of Dan took what Micah had made and the priest who belonged to them, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. And there was no deliverer because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rehob. Then they rebuilt the city and lived in it, and they named the city Dan after the name of Dan, their ancestor, who was born to Israel. But the name of the city was Laish at first. And the people of Dan set up carved images for themselves, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, this is where we find out he was truly a Levite, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. That's a long time from now. They set up Micah's carved images that he made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. Now, I would like to tell you that there was some group there to come and smash those Danites and do, you know, and you know, have a happy ending to the movie, right? But that's not the case. Sadly, we see what happened in verses 27 to 31. The Danites killed the unsuspecting people of Laish. They burned their city, only to rebuild their own on the same site. They renamed the city to wipe out all the prior history and began a new ungodly era in that location. The worship of idols continued, and the priest, Jonathan, was there to tell them what they wanted to hear. And this abomination continued until the day of the captivity of the land. So the last two chapters, we see this downward spiral away from the Lord that was taking place in the land. And when the people do what is right in their own eyes, this will always, always be the result. Why? Because the heart is deceitful. Jeremiah 17:9. And when man follows his heart, this will be the result. And all we need to do to look at this up close and personal rather than back in history is look at our society. Our society is following a very similar path in doing what is right in our own eyes. I looked up a thing on do what is right, or do what thou wilt. It was a name that was a title that came out. And I want to read this. This came from Wikipedia. And Thelema is a Western esoteric and occult or social or spiritual philosophy in a new religious movement that was founded in the early 1900s by an evil, evil man named Aleister Crowley. He was an English writer. He died in 1947, and he's had a profound impact on our society. He was an English writer, a mystic, an occultist, and a ceremonial magician. Central to Thelema is the concept of discovering and following one's, quote, true will, a unique purpose that transcends ordinary desires. Crowley's system begins with the Book of the Law, a text he maintained was dictated to him by a non-corporal identity named Iwas. The book outlines key principles, including the axiom, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." That sounds like doing what's right in your own eyes? It kind of is. "Do what thou wilt" is the whole of the law, emphasizing personal freedom and the pursuit of one's true path guided by love. Now, you could go and Aleister Crowley is just about as evil as a guy as you could find out. And we could dig deeper into this. Not the message, but the message is very plain. But if you look and you study how this has permeated our society and culture, you would be shocked. I've got a five-hour video series called Hell's Bells. And he gets into Aleister Crowley and some other people that he was very, very, very influential in the beginning and the continuance of the rock culture. And if you look at our culture today, the "do what thou wilt" is permeated in a big way, the rock music culture. It's permeated yoga, tarot divination, Wicca, Hindu tantras, Buddhism, the drug culture, sexual promiscuity, the occult, and we could go on and on and on and on. Doing what is right in your own eyes, or do what thou wilt, is a message from the pit of hell. And it's diametrically opposed to the gospel that says this. Romans 12, 1 and 2. "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect." It's anything but do what you will, or do what is right in your own eyes. Because that doesn't work.
In the early 80s, there was a rock band that came out of Australia called AC/DC, mm-hmm. and they had a song named after this philosophy. And I think all their guitar players after that died of drug overdoses and things like that. They were just horrible.
Yeah, if you want to really be, this is about 15 years old, but if you want to read or hear how much that's permeated the rock culture, and a lot earlier than you might think, I'll lend it to you. It's about 4 or 5 hours long. Don't listen to more than about a half hour at a time because it makes you nauseous. But these guys, words matter.
Yeah.
And people took those words, and we're seeing it played out in our culture today.
Absolutely.
As we saw it played out
back
in Judges. Yes.
Somebody could take these couple of chapters out and make it mean something
something entirely different, you have to know the context.
You have to know the context of what it said. Yep.
Right.
But thankfully, we have the Spirit of God who has turned us from that culture and has given us verses like Romans 12, 1 and 2. Great verses. And when we do that, the peace that passes all understanding will guard our hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Let's pray.